Welcome back to the Fitz News Studios, another edition of your Week in Review. We've got a big update in the case of Colleton County Clerk of Court Becky Hill, a major escalation in the investigation and a broadening of the potential criminal allegations against the official who presided over Alec Murdoch's double homicide trial last year. We're going to bring you up to speed on the very latest on the Becky Hill case. Also, I'm going to sit down with Andy Fancher as our ongoing efforts to hold law enforcement in South Carolina accountable took a wild turn down on Sullivan's Island, South Carolina. Our reporting has led to some very interesting circumstances down there and some accountability for a badly misbehaving cop. We're going to bring you the latest on that as I sit down with Andy. And last but not least, Dylan Nolan. We've been talking politics for several weeks now as the first and South presidential primary approaches. Dylan and I are going to sit down and walk through the very latest on this race, which is taking place as you watch this. That's right, folks. South Carolina's voting now. What's the Palmetto State going to decide? We'll walk you through all that and more on this week's edition of the Week in Review. So it's been a quiet few weeks on the Murdoch murders, crime, and corruption front. The big evidentiary hearing for Alec Murdoch that was held last month, resulting in the denial of a new trial for Alec Murdoch. Obviously, one of the central figures of that hearing was Becky Hill, the Colleton County Clerk of Court, whose alleged jury tampering was the basis of Murdoch's request for a new trial. And it was determined at that hearing, initially anyway, that the alleged tampering did not cross the line into violating Alec Murdoch's constitutional rights. As a result, former Chief Justice Jean Toll denying him a new trial. Obviously, that will be appealed. We've still got a long way to go on the legal side of it. But for now, mercifully for many of us, the Murdoch coverage has died down, and we've been able to focus on a ton of other stories over the last few weeks, which is something I have certainly enjoyed. But the Becky Hill investigation, which had been raised in the weeks leading up to that big evidentiary hearing, Murdoch's new trial hearing, escalating over the last couple weeks. There has been a flurry of activity related to the Becky Hill investigation. Now, right in the days leading up to this big evidentiary hearing, the missing cell phone that Becky Hill had that she used during the Murdoch trial back in 2023 was found. It was located. But SLED agents, according to my sources, agents with the South Carolina State Law Enforcement Division, SLED, the top law enforcement agency here in the Palmetto State, did not pick that phone up until the day before Alec Murdoch's big hearing on January 29. It was, however, retrieved, and in the days after the hearing, SLED began the process of issuing search warrants for information related to that device. Now, we've seen a little bit come out about the contents of this phone, some messages that were in a sealed exhibit tied to Alec Murdoch's big hearing, which would point to there being some substance to the allegations against Becky Hill that she was not an impartial arbiter during that trial down in Walterboro, South Carolina last year. But as we've dug into the investigation, we found a few things that we wanted to share with you as it relates to what's happening with the Becky Hill probe. First of all, it is not just an investigation into obstruction of justice. It is not just an investigation into jury tampering, and it is not just an investigation into misconduct in office. All of those things are part of it, but there's a new angle to this inquiry, folks, a perjury angle, specifically related to testimony that Becky Hill gave on the stand at Alec Murdoch's big evidentiary hearing last month. On several occasions, we are told, both defense attorneys, prosecutors, and the presiding judge believe Becky Hill perjured herself when she gave answers. Now, we pulled a clip. I wanted to play this real quick. This is a section of the testimony where Becky Hill is asked specifically by former Chief Justice Jean Toll about her interactions with the media. I want you to watch not only the answers, but I want you to watch at the very end the expression on the former Chief Justice's face. Let's take a look.
Did you ever allow anyone from the press to view these sealed exhibits?
No, ma'am.
Did you allow Netflix to ever examine the exhibits for trial?
No, ma'am.
How did you handle exhibits? Because you did have the press have great access to the exhibits, and you say several times in your book that you had to stay after to be sure that you interacted with the press about these exhibits. That's true, is it not?
That is true. We had Mr. Jay Bender, and then we had the pool photographers and someone from maybe the state, I believe, or the posting courier, along with the court reporters, someone from court administration, and then someone from the clerk's office every night that would go over the exhibits to make sure everything was correct and in within our domain.
Were any press people ever allowed to view the exhibits, even the sealed exhibits that you had on file?
No, ma'am. No, ma'am.
What was the methodology for allowing them to examine the exhibits? How'd you handle that?
I wasn't there a whole lot with when we did this every night, but it's my understanding that the people that were involved with the exhibits, and especially the court reporters, and there was a certain time frame that they were allowed to take their pictures, and everything was all of the pictures were looked at by the court reporters that were there and the lady from court administration, along with someone from my office and Mr. Jay Bender, to make sure that everything was done correctly.
What I'm asking is how you handled having them, the press, view these exhibits.
If I remember correctly, the press, we had certain designated photographers and then someone, I think, from the state of the or the posting courier, and they were responsible for putting it out to on a stream for the rest of the media to access.
And would they do that by photographing the exhibits as they were in your possession after court was over that day?
That is correct.
All right. And how did you handle the sealed exhibits in terms of their availability when these press people are there photographing exhibits?
They stayed sealed.
And so you think that the you're aware of the fact that some of these on-the-scene photographs of the two decedents found their way into the public press. You're aware of that, are you not?
Yes, ma'am, I am, yes.
And you contend that they photographed them in the courtroom?
That is what I heard.
All right.
So those questions, former Chief Justice Hull obviously asking them twice, and as you could see the look on her face in response to Becky Hill's answers, raises some questions. Now, again, we don't know exactly what the perjury investigation of Becky Hill entails, but we are told by sources close to the investigation that SLED agents have been to the Collin County Courthouse within the last 2 weeks, that they've been taking pictures of rugs and carpets inside that building in the hopes of matching those with images that they believe contain sealed exhibits. Now, I want to point something out as it relates to our media outlet. We have obtained a number of these sealed exhibits. We obtained many of them before the trial even began. But our policy from the beginning was never to publish these sealed exhibits. Again, that would violate Clifton Newman's orders. We took that responsibility very seriously. And in fact, I want to point something else out. During the Murdoch trial, the one key piece of evidence that put Alec Murdoch in a box as it related to trying to defend himself on the charges of murdering his wife and younger son was the video, the 44-second video that was taken by his son, late son Paul Murdoch, in the moments before his death, a kennel video of a dog that Paul Murdoch shot on his phone that Alec Murdoch apparently didn't know was filmed. But that is the video that placed him at the scene at the time of the murders. And we had it, folks. We had it. Could have published it well in advance, but we wanted to make sure the jury heard it first. And so this news outlet did not publish that video until the jurors in Murdoch's case had heard it. Again, that's what you're supposed to do with this kind of evidence. Now, that exhibit was ultimately released. It was not a sealed exhibit. But the sealed files in this case, folks, they're graphic. They're gruesome. They depict crime scene photos, videos. They depict autopsy photos, videos. They are just incredibly difficult images and clips to watch. And so we've never made those public, whether it was the ones that we received before, during, or after this trial. We've never made them public, and we won't. And here's why. Because the reason we obtained them in the first place was simple. We wanted to assess the veracity of the testimony that was provided in that trial. We wanted to be able to tell our audience that what they were hearing from these experts, whether for the state of South Carolina prosecuting Alec Murdaugh, or on the other side, the defendants, his attorneys, we wanted to make sure that those experts, that we were providing our audience with the best assessment of their testimony. That's why we looked at those exhibits. And as we repeatedly said throughout the aftermath of the trial, those exhibits very capably reinforced where the state of South Carolina was coming from. In fact, they pointed to the theories advanced by the state, which again pointed to Alec Murdaugh as the perpetrator of this graphic double homicide. So just a quick word on that, but where will this go for Becky Hill? Again, we don't know. We don't know who she shared this information with. We don't know what those folks did with that information, but clearly the South Carolina State Law Enforcement Division is hot on the trail, not only of those leaks of sealed exhibits, but also whether or not Becky Hill lied about it when she testified. Again, for the very latest on the Becky Hill investigation, keep it tuned to FitzNews.com. We were the first to report on so many of the aspects of this ongoing inquiry. We will continue to drive that coverage moving forward. So this media outlet, we've obviously had a longstanding tradition of supporting law enforcement. It's one of the core functions of government. So cops, courts, prosecutors, all of that are things that this media outlet has stood for a long time. But part of standing for that core function means holding it accountable. And clearly, if you follow Fitz News, we've been holding judges accountable for a very long time. But that accountability also has to extend to the badges that are sworn to protect us and to serve us. Sometimes that commitment strays. Sometimes it veers into territory that is downright hostile and harassing. We're dealing with one of those situations now. Andy Fancher joining us. You've been covering what we've been calling the pervert on patrol, a name very familiar to our audience from the past, an officer of the law who's been in trouble repeatedly over the course of his career, Chris Griffin down on Sullivan's Island. Mm-hmm. Andy, a couple weeks ago, you dropped a big story on the very latest. Before we get to what happened this week, give us a little background on the first story that you dropped earlier this year.
Well, my story 2 weeks ago was actually a continuation of your coverage back from 2021, where you wrote on sexual harassment lawsuits against Chief Griffin that emanated from an incident in 2019, resulting in his permanent ban from the South Carolina Police Chiefs Association, in which the suit listed that he was sending unsolicited, sexually explicit text messages over and over and over again to two separate female officers. All the while, he kept his job.
We couldn't believe this guy didn't get fired back then. The city stood by him, obviously. And what was crazy about that, too, is that he took the place of a police chief that had been embroiled in a sex scandal. So it was like, what? Can you guys not learn here?
What's going on Sullivan's Island? Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad that you mentioned the town stood by him, because there's going to be a reoccurring name here, and that is the town administrator, Andy Bink. Mm-hmm. So in the wake of that 2021 suit, Andy Bink came out and said, "We have found no evidence of any wrongdoing under Griffin's leadership. Business as usual, nothing to see here. Please move along." Now, I bring up Andy Bink because something anecdotal that you had mentioned in your previous coverage was how Chris Griffin, what was it that he signed with one of his subordinates? They wanted a security interest in a property they co-owned.
Right. Which now, is not
exactly due
kosher,
to a town ordinance that's publicly accessible, it prohibits that kind of relationship. Mm-hmm. Notice how Andy Bink supposedly signed off on that deposit. And Andy Bink will come in later as well in this story. But that leads us to where we were 2 weeks ago, because it was made public that Chris Griffin was placed on administrative leave. That is all the town gave to the public. That was until multiple individuals familiar with the inner workings of Sullivan's Island Police Department reached out to us, and then me directly, to share what exactly was supposedly going on in that office.
Walk us through some of these new allegations, because they're very similar
to the things that we heard back in 2021, but almost seemed like they were escalating. Walk us through.
Escalating, almost as if he was emboldened by a lack of punishment. So what we're dealing with is sexual harassment, intimidation, stalking, all at the hands of technology provided by the taxpayers.
Body cameras and...
Body cameras. Yeah. Ford Access technology, because they had all gotten new squad cars, supposedly, and there was tracking devices on the squad cars. I was told some officers went so far as to try to disable some of these tracking devices, specifically when these officers discovered that someone was accessing their body cameras remotely.
Oh, wow.
And that is of interest, because when you're wearing your body camera like this, you can't see the purple light indicating that somebody is watching you remotely. So if you go to the bathroom, or if you're hanging your body camera on its vest next to your assigned shower, that could be a problem.
Well, let's talk about the shower, too. Weren't there some allegations that this guy's leaving his underwear?
Not just in anybody's assigned shower, a female subordinate's assigned shower. Now, I don't know what my limitations are on this program to say exactly the quotes that I have been provided by him, but...
Dylan can bleep it. Yeah,
Dylan can, can you bleep it, Dylan?
We've dropped a few F-bombs on the show.
Yeah, we've done it in the past. So prior to him assigning this specific female that I was told was the death of him, he proclaimed to his office that he was going to, quote, it.
Oh, wow.
Not her.
It. Oh, my gosh.
She was not even human. And that is when he subsequently deployed a series of just completely appalling techniques that just resulted in report after report after report. Some of the individuals familiar with SIPD tell me that the inflatable sex doll, that stayed in Chris's office. So we don't need to worry about that. But an inflatable unicorn... inflatable snakes, stuffed snakes, leaving that in the female's locker room, in her assigned bathroom stall, all the while supposedly going into her locker because he told her he needed the password to her locker. This is coming from multiple people familiar with the inner workings of SIPD.
Wow. So all this comes to a head this week. There's a Sullivan's Island Town Council meeting. There's a notice for an executive session conversation about Chris Griffin, but we don't get there, do we? Tell us, Andy, what happened prior to that executive session.
Right. So we find out during the executive session that went on for over 2 hours, mind you, that he had actually submitted his resignation in the hours leading up to it. Therefore,
convenient.
How convenient. Therefore, nothing to see here. Please move along, everyone. They came out of executive session to simply say that we have accepted the resignation. Mm-hmm. But before they do that, they give Chris Griffin a $10,000, proverbial $10,000 jumbo check before they send him on his way.
For what reason? What's the rationale? Why are they paying him?
Well, I had conferred with you on this, and I believe it was our understanding that it was to perhaps mitigate him taking legal action against the town. So here, we're going to give you $10,000, which it's worth noting, if we go back to November of last year, the town lost $105,000 to this man on a separate lawsuit in which town administrator Andy Bink was also named. So what are we up to now? We're up to $115,000. At the hands of Chris Griffin?
Well, we may not be done yet, depending on potential lawsuits that could flow into Sullivan's Island as a result of his conduct.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, the three people to have sued Sullivan's Island or Chris and or Chris in the past, they were all female officers. Mm-hmm. So you're right. There's nothing to say that this can't happen again. But this is kind of what I do want to segue to, because when I'm on this show, I obviously talk a lot about police officers, right?
Sure.
And it's warranted, depending on their actions. But SIPD, from what I've observed, those are some good officers. And from what I've heard, they are elated by the new leadership as of Tuesday night. Deputy Chief, now Chief Glenn Meadows, I'm told by folks very familiar with SIPD, is a godsend. Mm-hmm. Righting the wrongs that weren't even his wrongs to begin with. So shame on Chris Griffin for doing this to a department. Police officers already work such difficult jobs. So why include stalking? Not only stalking your subordinates, but their dependents.
Oh, wow.
Why follow them out of their jurisdiction? Why allegedly place hidden cameras in females' offices? It's reprehensible. So,
and the bigger question, Andy, why was this behavior allowed to continue for so long when there was a clearly demonstrated pattern? I mean, that lifetime ban from the Law Enforcement Association, that should have been a huge red flag to the city. I mean, that's indicative of conduct that those folks have clearly determined, you know, reached a level that warranted such drastic action, and yet they let this guy stick around for years. I mean, gosh, I would hate to be on the receiving end of those lawsuits, because, I mean, you've got definitional negligence on the part of whoever kept this guy in his position.
Which is why I don't want to point fingers. I just want to observe the facts here. Town Administrator Andy Bink determined there was no evidence of wrongdoing when he was banned from the state's Police Chief Association. Mm-hmm. Andy Bink supposedly notarized that loan with his subordinate, even though there's a town ordinance prohibiting Griffin from engaging in a relationship like that. Town Administrator Andy Bink was in 2023 listed in a sexual harassment among other suit alongside Griffin.
Oh, wow.
And I'm told by folks intimately familiar with town administration that Andy Bink was supposed to retire before the allegations against Chris came out last winter.
Oh, wow. Tangle web down there in the island. As a former Sullivan's Island resident, I was down there for a year or so on Mark Sanford's campaign way back 2 decades ago, but a beautiful place. But, man, this is just such a stain on that community down there, this guy. I'm so glad they got him out. Also very glad to hear the reports you're getting about the new chief, as you said, a godsend, coming in and righting these wrongs. You've also heard from a lot of folks, not only very appreciative of the work you did to expose this guy, Andy, but also some additional information coming in. Share us what you've been able to obtain in the aftermath of your reporting.
Yeah, in the aftermath of Pervert on Patrol, which I'll claim credit for that one. That was
genius.
One of my better titles. I have received emails from folks, not just subordinates, not just officers, but civilians attesting to similar behavior from Chris. And there was one email that I wanted to read with you. I've gotten clearance to read it as an anonymous sender.
Sure, absolutely.
So I received this within 2 days of publishing the initial Pervert on Patrol. In 1997, when just a young officer, Griffin low-key stalked me when I was renting on Marshall Boulevard. My car was broken into, left unlocked, as we all did at the time. He would appear on my doorstep to tell me he was still looking for my CDs, come to the restaurant I was working at, ignoring the obvious crimes taking place there, for months and months, until my boyfriend at the time told him to stop.
Wow. And that's back in the late 90s, you said?
In 97, wow. Which, if we know our history of Chris, that's when he first got there.
Right.
So we're dealing with a climate, with the behavior, essentially starting at day one. Mm. And at least in 2019, enabled to the point where we are now.
Unbelievable. Andy, excellent work on this. I am firmly convinced that it was your coverage, which is what led the town to finally take action to the extent they did, but finally push this across the finish line to get this guy out of a job, out of this position of power over folks that he was harassing on taxpayer time, using taxpayer resources, just a horrible abuse of public trust. So excellent work on your part to get this exposed. Also want to thank you for the message that this sends to law enforcement agencies across the state of South Carolina. I want to be clear, we're talking to all these agencies. We've covered scandals like this in the past up in Malden, South Carolina. We will continue to cover them. Obviously, police officers deserve the right to blow off steam. They have tough, stressful jobs. Certainly, we understand that, but it's got to be on their time, and it cannot involve this sort of power play, manipulation, harassment, stalking. And so if those traits are evident in law enforcement officers in South Carolina, and we can document it and we can expose it, rest assured, no matter how much we support the law enforcement community and the badges in this state, we will continue to hold them accountable. Andy's excellent reporting, the latest example of that. So you've heard about our accountability over the judicial branch and over prosecutors. Look for it to continue to expand as it relates to those sworn to protect and serve here in South Carolina. With one exception, South Carolina's first in the South Republican presidential primary has always picked the GOP nominee for president. It is a definitional bellwether, a state that picks presidents. Again, the only time that South Carolina's barometer was off was 2012 when the state supported Newt Gingrich for president. Mitt Romney obviously ended up being the nominee that year. Look how that turned out. But South Carolina is a state that has historically had the number of the Republican nominees. In 2016, obviously, the state was critical to launching Donald Trump on his voyage to his first term in the White House, a big victory for the former president here in the Palmetto State, going up against Nikki Haley at the time, Tim Scott, a whole group of establishment politicians supported the candidacy of Marco Rubio that year. So there was some tension there, but Trump ends up nominating Nikki Haley to be his UN ambassador. They have sort of a detente for a few years. Nikki Haley then later says she won't run against Trump if he seeks the presidency in 2024, ends up changing her mind, running against him along with a huge field of contenders. I'm here with Dylan Nolan. We've watched that field winnow over the past few months, few weeks in particular, as the early primary states have weeded out some of the other opponents. Former Vice President Mike Pence dropped out. U.S. Senator Tim Scott dropped out, endorsed Trump. Chris Christie dropped out, endorsed no one. So we've had a lot of candidates. Ron DeSantis flamed out spectacularly, dropped out ahead of South Carolina, endorsed Trump. So as this race has evolved, we are now left with two candidates, Donald Trump and Nikki Haley. Now, in most situations, based on the outcomes we've seen up to this point in the race and based on the polling here in South Carolina, most folks are wondering, what is Nikki Haley still doing in the race? Well, Dylan, you went and saw her speak this week down in Beaufort, South Carolina. What is she doing still in the race?
She made it very clear with her sharp attacks on Donald Trump that at this point she is in the race solely to battle Trump. It was very interesting towards the back half of her speech. She's obviously encouraging folks to come out and vote for her. But she says, you know, South Carolina is not the end of the road, implying, I know I'm going to lose South Carolina, but saying that she's going to be moving on and at least battling through Super Tuesday.
Well, in fact, she just announced a seven-figure ad buy as we're taping this program. Seven-figure Super Tuesday ad buy, making it very clear she's staying in the race. Let's rewind this week a little bit, Dylan, because this was going to be, if you looked at the evolution of the early voting states at Iowa and New Hampshire, this had the makings of a potentially pivotal showdown between Haley.
You've been arguing this for a long time. I've been arguing against it for a long time. We could go down that path again.
Fair enough. But my argument is very simple. If Haley had gotten a second place finish in Iowa, which she was poised to do before this massive snowstorm, before Chris Christie's hot mic, where he basically neutered his own ability to endorse her, I feel like that could have shifted things in New Hampshire more in her direction. She obviously fell short of Trump by a little over 11-12%.
I think you fundamentally misunderstand this election if you think that she has a shot.
I don't think she has a shot.
I don't think that she, no matter what, she is siding with the people who are attacking the Republican base. Why would the Republican base side with her? I'd agree if this was a general election, because I think she's far more electable than Donald Trump, whom a lot of people dislike. That being said, this is a Republican primary, and she's clearly taking the side of the people who are taking a hatchet to the person who's going to be the Republican nominee.
Fair enough. My point was merely that South Carolina could have been a competitive state for her.
Certainly more than it's going to be, and fair enough. I'll accept that.
Okay, I'm not arguing that she was going to win. I'm arguing that it could have been a high noon situation, that it could have been a more pivotal race than it's obviously ended up being. But my basic point was that we're sitting here looking at a week that was supposed to be somewhat dramatic, somewhat interesting, somewhat entertaining to cover. It's ended up being a complete non-event because the race is essentially over. And we were going back and forth a little bit the last time about this crossover campaign, about Democrats that may come out to support Haley. And in the last few weeks, it has become just overt. Haley is actively courting Democratic voters in an effort to bump up that percentage here in South Carolina. We've seen her send out mailings. In fact, we got tons of these mailings here. I mean, they're just being bombarded.
And by the way, behind the scenes, for months, she's been courting the Democratic donors, which are the people who have paid for these mailings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So walk me through the reception you saw her get down in Beaufort, and then I want you to contrast it with what you saw when you watched Donald Trump earlier this month.
She received a really warm welcome, and I think that she had a pretty good-sized crowd down there in Beaufort, obviously not comparable to what Donald Trump pulled in down in North Charleston, but it was a very different type of event. I would say most of her crowd, and I think that this was obviously a function of it being in Beaufort as much as anything, were the Blue Plate Special crowd, you know, the AARP crowd, if you catch my drift. But, you know, that's Beaufort. It was just beautiful that night down there on the waterfront. And they loved her, but, you know, the enthusiasm of that type of crowd is just completely different from what I would say is the electricity of a Donald Trump crowd. I felt like I was at a very standard, normal political speech, something that you would expect a Jeb Bush, a Marco Rubio to give. Nikki Haley was very well rehearsed, very well prepared. She spoke for around 45 minutes, no teleprompter. But it was clearly a stump. There was, I don't think, but a couple of lines that were extemporaneous, you know, kind of added in spur of the moment. She, of course, capitalized on the legislative and economic development that happened while she was governor, some of which she spurred, some of which happened despite her, all of which you covered thoroughly throughout those years. And then she moved on to both contrasting herself with Donald Trump and with Joe Biden.
Well, before this speech in Beaufort, though, Haley gave a very highly publicized, highly anticipated speech in Greenville earlier this week, a state of the race speech. And I wanted to throw this theory to you and see what your response was to this. I felt that this was one of the more pathetic things I've seen in covering politics. You essentially had a campaign sending out hints and feelers that there may be a big announcement, which at this point, the only announcement is she's dropping out, right? I mean, that's the only newsworthy thing Nikki Haley can do at this stage of the race, given her position in the polls down 30, best case scenario. They use all that speculation to gin up attention for this speech, and then it's nothing, nothing. So what does it say about a campaign that they have to use, again, that speculation of interest in her demise to generate attention for this event?
I mean, it's certainly telling.
Yeah.
It is what it is. You've said it. You used the word pathetic. That's certainly one word that could accurately describe that move. You also accurately called before the event started that it was going to be a fake, which I thought was a good call.
Yeah. Well, and I think the dynamic of this race really started shifting, you know, and again, I've written about the collapse of her early state momentum. She did have some early state momentum. It evaporated in January. But I also wanted to draw your attention to another critical period that was happening right behind the scenes of that earlier this year, when we saw Vivek Ramaswamy, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump Jr., Tucker Carlson, all almost in unison, begin to vehemently, vigorously attack the notion of Nikki Haley as a number two. And from what we've been told by sources very close to the Trump world, particularly here in South Carolina, where, again, they've been joined at the hip with him for a long time, but that he was seriously considering making Nikki Haley his vice president.
Well, I believe that. I just hearing some of the things that he was saying on the trail, he's a kind of guy, and a lot of politicians do this, where they'll test an idea, where they'll kind of tease it out in public and see what reception it gets. And I think that for him was like sticking his foot in a hornet's nest. Now, it's crazy to me, after Donald Trump put a lot of people in positions of power in his first administration who turned around and backstabbed him and completely tried to prevent him from carrying out his agenda, that he would consider making Nikki Haley his VP. But it seems as though he was serious, and it seems as though right now he's equally as serious about not making her his VP. He, of course, announced this in North Charleston to massive applause from the audience there.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about that. You mentioned the potential for Trump's second term, a non-consecutive term. Obviously, you mentioned how in the first term there were some instances where he—
Like half his cabinet.
Sold out, yeah. Let's talk about it. And again, Fitz News been very critical of Trump's sellouts on fiscal policy when he was in the office the first term. particularly signing that COVID bill at the on the way out that he referred to as a disgrace, which, by the way, you want to talk about Bidenflation, that contributed mightily to it. So, again, some of that onus is on Trump. But I was asked this week, one of these national reporters that's come down to cover this race, I think writing for the New Republic, was asking me about Trump's potential second term. Would he be less inclined to get dragged down into the swamp the way he was in his first term? Because let's be honest, Dylan, this guy promised to drain the swamp, but was literally surrounded by swamp creatures from day one.
Well, it's hard to find people who are competent and able to operate in D.C. who aren't people who operate in D.C.
Fair enough. So what's the answer?
The answer is to take the people who he vetted through his first administration, who proved that they were able to competently carry out his agenda. One person who I think is a great example of this would be like Kash Patel. He started working for Devin Nunes in the House. He then was moved over to executive agencies, first working in counterterrorism, and then moving up to the Department of Defense, basically being the president's voice over there at the DOD. But all the way, he was fighting against these swamp creatures, as you've termed them, who were basically trying to keep the president, as members of the executive branch, from carrying out his agenda as he's constitutionally entitled to. And as if we were a functional country, he would be able to, with them working in concert with the president's appointees, not against the president's appointees.
Are you surprised? Let me ask you this, as we look at sort of the back and forth between Haley and Trump over the last couple weeks here in South Carolina. Obviously, Haley's attacks against Trump have had no effect on his popularity in the Palmetto State. He remains as popular as ever. He's actually ticked up a bit. Conversely, those attacks have raised her negative ratings in the polls here in South Carolina, her unfavorability much higher than it was as recently as November when Winthrop University polled her favorability, unfavorability. She's seen a huge spike in negative impressions of her based on the attacks against Trump. Is there not a case to be made against Trump? And how is Nikki Haley so inadequate in making it?
You know, it's interesting. I think that the Democrats really overplayed their hand by encouraging Donald Trump to be indicted by these state officials and then following up with federal indictments. And I say that the Democrats encouraged this because there is direct proof that the White House, the DOJ, worked with the prosecutors who have brought these state-level charges against Trump. But as Ron DeSantis said, these other Republican candidates were doing a lot better before those indictments were brought. And then these other Republican candidates were forced to make a very tough choice, which is, do I say, you know, Trump, because he's been indicted, is not fit to lead this country, which is something that a lot of Republican primary voters don't feel is true, or do I stand with Trump? And in which case, why not just nominate Trump? So I think it's very difficult for her to make a case because she has such a narrow lane in which to make a case.
Yeah, that's true. So you got the props there.
Yeah, I did bring some souvenirs. I'm a bit of a political nerd, so I love to grab these kinds of things. I do have a collection at my house, but I've got the Trump 2024, and then I have the SC Loves Nikki sign.
All right, so as we look at these, I'm going to go ahead and make my prediction. We've heard some of Nikki's supporters, including former Republican Party Chairman Kayton Dawson, obviously a guy who knows his stuff here in South Carolina, predicting 900,000 people voting in this election that's taking place today as you watch this Saturday, February the 24th. I don't think we're going to have that big of a turnout. I'm going to predict 650,000 voters turnout. That will be short of the record set back in 2016. I'm going to predict 62% of those go to Trump, around about 36% go to Nikki Haley, a few stragglers there on the remaining 2% or so. Does my math add up, Dylan? I did go to South Carolina government-run schools. So
I think you got it right.
I think I got it right. But that's kind of what I'm looking at. And, you know, that's when you factor the massive crossover effort, the massive overt push to get Democrats to vote in this election, that's just embarrassing for Nikki Haley.
Yeah, and it, you know, I wonder, you asked me last week, what's Nikki Haley getting out of this? And of course, I made a coy joke that you would know better than me. But I was thinking about it all week, you know, what is Nikki Haley going to get out of this? And I think that there might be a bargain here. I think Tim Scott is certainly looking to get himself a spot in Trump's administration if he can't score the VP slot, which means that there will be a South Carolina Senate seat open. And obviously, Lindsey Graham can't last forever, although Mitch McConnell has shown that you, and of course, Strom Thurmond, show that you could be in the Senate until you literally physically die. But he's up there in the years. Point being, I think U.S. Senate might be something that she pursues in the future.
Interesting.
Do you think that the damage that she's done to her brand by running against Trump in South Carolina would preclude her from winning that election? Or do you think that the South Carolina GOP would ensure that she didn't face anybody serious in the primary and walked right into that seat?
I think it depends on the extent to which Trump maintains a hold on the party after this election cycle. And obviously a lot of it depends on whether he wins and what he does if he wins. I think that that power he holds over the electorate here right now, again, we're seeing a demonstration of it in this race. If he's able to maintain that, I think the future is very bleak for Nikki Haley. I think a lot of doors are going to continue to be shut for her. Certainly the moneyed support that's behind her can open some of those doors. But again, we're seeing right now that all the money in the world isn't buying Nikki Haley a whole lot in her backyard, Dylan.
That's true. I think she's got a lot longer of a life than Donald Trump, and we'll see if MAGA continues once he's off the political stage.
Well, we certainly know where Donald Trump Jr., who many view as the next in line,
apparent.
We know what he thinks about Nikki Haley. Again, he was one of those core Trump supporters that came out aggressively against any talk of her being a VP. But Dylan, we'll know these numbers soon. Tonight, we'll have returns. Keep it tuned to FitzNews.com. Myself, Dylan Nolan, Mark Powell will be following the results of the 2024 First in the South election. We've been covering it, again, for the better part of the past year. Had hoped it would be a little more climactic, but hey, you know, we'll give you the very latest on those numbers as they come in and our analysis of what they mean for this election moving forward. All right, folks, that's a wrap for this week's edition of Your Week in Review. Before I go, I want to throw one thing at you. Category 6 hurricanes. There is a big push to modify the current hurricane strength scales to include a Category 6 classification of storms. Now, the truth about why they're pushing this is not exactly what you think. So if you haven't checked it out yet, go to FitzNews.com. Yes, we cover weather, too. We live on the South Carolina coast. Hurricanes are a fact of life here. We've covered every major storm that's come rolling through the eastern seaboard over the last few years. But if you want to know the truth about those Category 6 storms and what the real deal is behind that attempt to reclassify, go check out FitzNews.com, where we've got the scoop on those Category 6 hurricanes. Thanks to everybody for tuning in this week. I want to thank everybody in particular for liking us, for subscribing to us. Most importantly, thanks to those of you subscribing to FitzNews.com. It's $8 a month, but as you see, we hold the system accountable. Cops, prosecutors, judges, you name it, politicians, everybody in the Palmetto State in positions of authority, we're here to make sure they exercise it the right way, the just way, the fair way, on behalf of you, the folks who support their salaries. Keep it tuned to Fitz News for the very latest on all those fronts and for an update on the 2024 First in the South presidential primary, which is drawing to a close today. We'll have all the latest on that big election right here on FitzNews.com.